All right, welcome back, everybody. Thanks for joining us for hour number two of Christian Worldview with Tony and Austin. This is Tony Beam, Director of Church and Community Engagement and Public Affairs for North Greenville University. I'm also a Christian snowflake and Director of Public Policy for the South Carolina Baptist Convention. My co-host is also a Christian snowflake, and he is a gardener extraordinaire. This is Austin Barker.
I can't believe you just did that. I saw what you did there, though. Good morning, everybody.
Well, I'm okay. That's enough. I'll lay that aside for now. You know, I'll turn this into about me, and this show's about policy and about philosophical ideas and theological constructs that support good policy as opposed to bad policy.
Can
overall.
I just be clear, though? I really don't care what people call me. I know who I am. I know what I'm about, and I know what God's called me to.
I'm with you
and
on that.
You and I talked last week about how God has called me to be a bridge builder and a peacemaker, and that is my calling from the Lord.
Right.
And that's not everybody's calling. And so I don't expect every Republican or every conservative to look like me or take exactly the same positions as I do. But what does really bother me is whenever they look at a person who knows God's calling on his life and is doing it and doing it well and say, you're a snowflake.
I have an appreciation
for you and for God's calling on your life. Can I get a little reciprocity here?
There are certain things that get me, and I need to work on not allowing those things to get me. I mean, I insulted for the cause of Christ is something that I expect and don't, you know, worry about. Insulted because somebody is passing judgment on my commitment to Christ is a different ball game.
Yeah, it feels different whenever it
lands in a different place.
When it's people, that's well said. When it's people that disagree with me on everything saying, you're wrong, you're stupid, and I'm like, well, you know, whatever.
Okay.
But whenever it's people who should be Christians, profess the name of Christ, and then they look at me and say, you know, and start throwing shade at me, then I'm like, I'm having trouble with you, brother.
It's almost like, you know, we're being burned at the stake, and somebody looks at the other guy and says, you're not burning as brightly as I am, so there must be something wrong with you, brother. What, you didn't drink your gasoline before you came out here? Okay, Andy's on line one. Hello, Andy.
Hey, good morning, gentlemen. Just to circle back kind of to that conversation, that I think your main point of being that, you know, we can't, we're supposed to be a different party, and we can't just, you know, do the same principles under a different umbrella. My personal opinion is that if Donald Trump was in office right now, we would still be voting to raise the debt ceiling $3 trillion. It would just be for stuff Donald Trump and the Republicans wanted versus the other party.
And that's what Donald Trump did, so yeah.
Yeah, absolutely, and he would continue to do that, and that's not fixing our country, that's not, you know, being different. I think the difference with Trump and where, like, what we really need, as you were talking about, you know, we need more patriotism and less narcissism. You know, Trump had some patriotism within the things that he did, but he was just such a narcissist that it clouded the ability for him to become reelected and to do things for the benefit of the country versus doing things because I have to win and you have to lose. And I think, you know, a personality that has more patriotism, less narcissism is the direction, and that would stand up to, hey guys, we just can't continue to raise debt ceilings, or we can't continue to do this under any party. We have to be America, not Republican, not Democrat. And that's not like a snowflake statement. That is just like the debt is going to destroy our country if we don't begin to do something about it. And somebody's got to, you know, take the reins on that and be able to, you know, have the love of country and the grit that people liked of Donald Trump to stand up and say, this is how we're going to fix this.
Yeah.
Hey,
no, that's well said.
I'm going to slide over here a little bit. I think there's room for another co-host.
No, we can put
here.
Yeah, we can put another
right
chair
in between us here.
We got chair room here in the middle. Well, yeah, you know, look, Andy's always been one of the most thoughtful, and I know Andy personally. We're friends. He's a thoughtful guy who tells me, like, this is a Law and Order quote, that can tell me when my britches are unbuttoned.
Uh-huh.
I mean, you know, and I'll take it from him because I know that his motivation is coming from a foundation of honoring God and serving the Lord scripturally.
Yeah.
So I just, I really appreciate Andy. Good words, sir. Yep. Dennis is another guy that we can put another chair.
That's right.
Yes, Dennis.
Hey, guys. Yeah, I guess I never thought I'd say this, but I guess you could go ahead and call me a Christian snowflake, too. Listen, this is my opinion on Donald Trump. I think his policy-wise, he's one of the greatest presidents I know I've ever seen in my lifetime,
right?
Possibly ever. His policies, actual policies, were outstanding. The country was booming.
Yes.
Yes.
Okay. COVID was not his fault.
No.
Right.
But as his character, he is a deeply flawed man.
Right.
He is very vindictive. I read something just 2 days ago where he had was calling Liz Cheney just all kind of names, calling like Mitch McConnell name, and they might even be deserving of it. But he's very immature. He's very shallow as character wise. Like
yes.
I said, policy wise, he's great, but. If he runs again in 2024, he is the definition of scorched earth. Yeah. There's no way I don't think we would win in 2024. But I do think he could serve the party very well by being strategic, because there is, I think, several Senate seats he could help win.
Right.
I know there's several House seats he could help win.
Absolutely.
So I hope he is just strategic and trying to win back the House and Senate and not just being vindictive and going after the people don't like.
Yeah, here's the problem, Dennis. Strategic means being willing to allow yourself to be in a lesser seat in order to advance somebody else's interest and their ability to help the country. And a narcissist can't do that. So that's the problem. That's the whole problem. And, you know, I want to make this point, Dennis, because you've been listening to this radio show for a long time. And, you know, I made the point over and over that we used to, as Christians, agree that character matters when it comes to leadership and that it matters most. And everybody seemed to agree when the character of the person in the White House was Bill Clinton or it was Barack Obama. But when it gets to be that the character of the person we want to be in the White House is not very good, then the question becomes, well, what do you want? You want a pastor for your president? You want somebody? Do you want a pastor or do you want a president? Because we're not electing a pastor. That's one of the most ridiculous arguments I've ever heard in my life.
As though politics plays by different rules than any other part of life.
Right. In other words, we don't want. Do I want the character of a pastor, a good pastor, in my president? Absolutely. Because ultimately, no matter what the good you do, if your character is bad, it will in the end, the good you do will be undermined. Because
I'll say this real quick. One thing I loved about Donald Trump was that he punched back. We needed that because Mitt Romney didn't punch back. George Bush didn't punch back.
Right.
They were an actual punching back.
Yep.
So I love that about Trump, that he actually punched back to the media and to the elite. But he'd turn around the next day and just blow all that with just something totally ridiculous, calling names like a fifth grader. And I don't know. Like I said, I love the man policy-wise, but character-wise, he was deeply flawed. And just really quick, we can have Donald Trump in 2024 with Ron DeSantis, except Ron DeSantis has a filter. He knows when to cut it off. And
exactly.
He, his press conferences are – oh, I love watching his press conferences.
Yeah.
Because he's got that fire like Donald Trump, but he cuts it off when he knows –
well, and
when
here's
to do that. So
here's
we do have
thing.
Somebody.
We do. And here's the thing, Dennis. This is what Ron DeSantis reminds me of. He's got the fire of Donald Trump. He's got the wit and wisdom of Ronald Reagan. And you put those two things together. I mean, Reagan could disarm a reporter with a, well, there you go again. I mean, he had the power of the American people behind him, for one thing. He was loved by the American people,
and
one of the most loved.
Not by 35%.
Not by 35%, by 60%.
Mm-hmm.
65. And he turned that into an ability. You remember when things were hanging in the balance, he would address the nation. And the next morning, everybody's like, why aren't you doing what this guy says? You know, that's the kind of leadership that can bring about change that last and can get. Reagan got reelected in a landslide. It was a foregone conclusion. I mean, the guy just crushed Mondale. But we can see that again if we get somebody like DeSantis. You're exactly right. Thanks, Dennis. Appreciate the call. Okay, I'm going to have to leave early today because I'm headed to Columbia for a resolutions committee meeting of the South Carolina Baptist Convention. We're wrapping up work on resolutions that will be presented at the convention in November. And Austin's going to be driving the ship here for the last 30 minutes. So what's on your mind? I mean, you've got all your sticky notes, and you wrote like a book over here while I was...
Sometimes that's just a venting, you know, I'm just trying to clarify my thoughts, and I do that best on paper. But I do have a quote here that was, I heard some grumpy old man say somewhere, and it's just been recently, that it says, American culture today is a hard place to live. We have created a hard place for us to live. And, you know, I heard that in the Ben and Jerry story that you did earlier, is that these progressives have created a hard place. It's hard for them to live in this world because they want to take, you know, these high-end principled stands against, you know, these policies, but they can only do it part of the time or else they just can't make a profit. They can't live in this world. It's a hard place for them to live. It's a hard place to be a true blue progressive. Well, in the same way we're having this, this is our conversation. This is our version of that same conversation. We've created a hard place for us to live.
Well, I used to, let's go back to the comment you made about being a bridge builder.
Yeah.
For a long time, I wanted that because I believe that we're better off when we can be different without being at each other's throats. I mean, that we can listen to differing perspectives and be genuine in our desire to understand what a person who disagrees with us is saying, and then counter that with what we believe is sound reasoning, foundational principles, and something that's grounded into the eternal, not simply rooted in, you know, the ground at the moment. You know, one of the best analogies I've ever heard, I don't even know where it came from, and you've heard me use it before, but, you know, there are actually people who are sailing. Imagine that they're on a sailboat and they're looking up, and the light that they're following is not the stars that are fixed and therefore giving them genuine navigation ability, but there's a light on the top of the mast of their own sailboat. And they're looking at that and going, I'm going to let that light be my guide. Well, I mean, anybody that's been just try to navigate at sea without a GPS or a compass knows that that's insanity. You have to look at fixed points that are eternal and don't move.
This is Frank Peretti's Moving the Chair.
Okay.
So he's in a dark room and there's a chair in the middle of it. And once you find that chair, then you've got a reference point, you know. And so you can use that chair to guide you. You know, you can go
find
3 feet
walls,
this way.
You can
orient yourself to the fixed point.
Right.
But then you pick up the chair and move around with you. I've got my fixed point right here with me.
Right.
You know, it's like you've kind of defeated the purpose.
You have. So that's that what I was trying, I think, and get back to what I was trying to get to, is that when you're having a disagreement, if you can find that fixed point where everybody has to have a reference point of agreement and then go out from there, the problem is people, the progressives, particularly the left, do not believe in any fixed points.
They do, because they do have some absolute principles that they won't veer from.
Yeah, okay. But they don't want to admit that.
Well, right. And that's a little bit of disingenuity, but I think you can eventually force them into acknowledging that's an absolute principle you're talking about there, right?
Like,
you're absolutely committed to that thing right there.
Well, and here's...
But the problem that I see is that we have different fixed points.
Well, and that's why I no longer believe that it's possible. I think I can be civil, and I don't have to have a scorched earth mindset against people that I disagree, but I've given up any hope of there being a compromise point, because there's nowhere to go. There's nowhere for me to compromise. So that leaves me with one thing. I've got to win. I mean, the only way that we stop what the other side is trying to do is to win, is to beat them, because they're not going to give an inch.
But if you take the pressure of outcomes out of that conversation and say, God is calling you to faithfulness, I mean, that's the way we live as Christians, is that we're not called to win. And so we don't have to harness our definition of success to the political outcomes, whether or not we win this vote.
But if I'm going to get in the political system and swim in that in those waters, then my desire to have a positive outcome revolves around winning the election.
But people give up their Christianity in order they lose the focus on faithfulness and they say we've got to win. And so if we got to accept a president with some shabby character with some problems here, then we'll do that because the focus is off. It's on winning.
Well, look, here's the thing. You know, mechanics don't fix the race car on the side of the road during a race. They fix the car in the garage. And then they take it and put it out on the track and hope that the work that they've done behind the scenes gives them the tool they need to win the race.
Let's go, Brandon.
Okay. Yeah, absolutely. By the way, that cheer
I'm
is spreading
sorry.
All over the place. Do you know that? That is
that
so
all the time.
Funny.
I use that all the time.
I know, but it's so funny now. Everybody's going, let's go, Brandon. You'll hear it at a baseball game.
But it's a metaphor.
It's a metaphor.
That's it's a metaphor for you hear what you wanted to hear, didn't you, ma'am?
Yeah, but it's also a metaphor for people saying, chanting something that they want to get away with without... So anyway, let's get back to the garage.
Sorry.
No, let me get back to the garage. So... For my party that I believe in, that I think needs to have the reins of power, where we have to fix the party is not while we're in a race. It's in the garage. Hmm. It's at the party level. Before we roll the car out onto the track and get in the race, we got to be sure that the engine's running properly and the car is fixed and it's ready for the race and that it's a sleek and very good machine that can endure the rigors of a political race. But when you wait until you're in the race and then say, well, I've got to have this guy because he's better than this guy, even though this guy's engine is terrible. I mean, he doesn't have a catalytic converter, and he's putting out noxious fumes. And we've got to stand by him because, you know, forget the garage. We don't have time to fix it. We're in a desperate situation, so we got to go with this guy. No, we need to make sure that what we're rolling out of the garage is what we really want on the track if we're going to win a race. And that way, you don't have to make these desperate decisions. You know, let's suppose we had nominated Ted Cruz to be the presidential candidate instead of Donald Trump. I have no problem. I mean, I'm not standing there trying to say to myself, well, golly, what am I going to – I got to vote for Trump because I can't vote for Hillary or I can't vote for Biden. I have to vote for Trump. But we've got – we get Ted Cruz out there, and now I'm going, wow, I can't wait to vote for Ted Cruz. I'm excited about voting for Ted Cruz. Ted Cruz is, he's got the value system, he's got the character, he's got all the stuff. He was in the garage. We developed a great candidate for the race. Now I'm excited about Ted Cruz instead of trying to push this broken car over the finish line ahead of somebody that I know is going to be worse than the person that I'm supporting.
Ted Cruz is a Christian snowflake.
Okay, well, he probably
I'm
is.
I'm just kidding. Again, I'm just
and
throwing
so is
a
Mitch McConnell.
But
and
you
so
have a
is,
lot of people out there who are saying that, you know, who the same way that you feel, the excitement that you feel about a person like Ted Cruz, they feel that way about Donald Trump.
Right.
You know?
But I'm just saying, even Marco Rubio, although Marco Rubio, I don't think has the – you have to have steel. You've got to have a spine of steel, but it can be a quiet steel, not an abrasive. You know, that takes me back to Ron DeSantis. I mean, the guy is steel, and yet he comes across as just he's Reagan, but he's more aggressive than Reagan. Reagan was a little bit passive. His passivity was actually something that he used as a political plus. Okay, we don't need that. We don't need that anymore. That worked in 1980. It won't work in 2024. So what we need is somebody who's steel. I mean, just, you know that the power is just under the surface, but it's under control. It's channeled. It's focused. That's Ron DeSantis.
And anytime a party loses an election like we did in 2020, it causes some soul searching within the party. But the problem that I see that's going on with this soul searching process is that we can't get over Donald Trump. We can't ask ourselves, why did we lose in 2020? The only answer to that is, well, they stole the election.
You know? And which means we're not having a genuine conversation about what really needs to be done. And that's bad. Carol, thanks for calling.
Yeah. I wanted to mention two thoughts in Isaiah 45, 1 through 8. You know, why did God call Cyrus his anointed? Why did he choose him? God can choose anybody. You know, he was mentioned 100 and so many years before he was ever born. Maybe it's because God wants the glory by choosing a flawed character that he will get the glory.
Yeah, but here's the problem. There are a lot of problems with the Cyrus example, Carol. First of all, we don't live in a world of kings and emperors. We live in a we the people constitutional republic where the people get to make the decisions about their leaders. So we the people are the ones who are supposed to have enough information and enough care about the character of the leaders that we put in office that we go out and do it. Now, that doesn't mean God's invisible hand, as they say, is not working behind the scenes, but I don't think that you know, one of the things we forget, you know, one of Cyrus's solutions to internal strife when he became the decided that the Jews could go back to Jerusalem is to force the worship of Marduk. In other words, he decided that it would be unifying if he could just bring back the worship of a pagan god. So, you know, saying that, elevating Cyrus to some type of sainthood status, because in retrospect we can look back and see that God used a pagan king to allow the Hebrews to go back and build the walls and rebuild the temple. All of that is in retrospect. We're trying to apply that to the here and now, to a present day character, and say that, well, in this moment, God is raising up a guy who doesn't have very good character, but he's doing a lot of good things. We're never going to know until we get 50, 100 years down the road if that was a good thing or a bad thing. The whole Cyrus examination and the application of Cyrus to Trump is not a very good application theologically, is all I'm saying, or historically.
But I like what Carol's doing. She's saying that God is at work and that God controls the reins of history.
Sure.
And so I like that impulse. You know,
well, that's true.
Yeah, that's right. And so there's a lot of good in what she's saying. I don't agree with the Cyrus Trump analogy, but I do agree that God rules history. Not human political
Absolutely.
Machinations.
And I agree with that, even as a snowflake Christian. We'll see you tomorrow.
All right. We'll be back. I mean, I got a question for you. I always have questions. We'll be back in 3 minutes. So my question for you this morning is, how do you convince someone that they're wrong? And I mean, I'm talking about in every domain of life, but particularly the one that we interact with most on this show is if someone holds a political view that is other than yours, and you believe yours is to be right and theirs to be wrong, how do you convince them of that? For instance, you may disagree with me, and maybe to a lesser extent, Tony, about our opinion of Donald Trump. You may believe that Donald Trump was good for America. I don't. So how do you go about convincing Austin Barker that he's wrong on that? Let me tell you how you don't, okay? And then I'll tell you one person's opinion of how you do. This morning at 5:40, starting this morning at 5:45, I was at Bob Jones playing basketball. I have a little group of guys that I like to get together with and burn some calories. And really, that's the focus for me, is just the exercise, the fitness, the burning calories, because I'm 38, and a lot of NBA players are retiring around that age, and I'm getting to the point where I'm thinking about retiring and taking up something that's a lower contact sport, because I take a risk every time I get on the court. And listen, there's guys that are, you know, in their 50s and a couple that are probably 60 and still playing. And I don't know how they do it, and I probably won't be. But whatever the case, I'm not good at basketball. Okay, I wish I were better because I'm clumsy and I was a nerd when I was growing up, and I didn't start playing sports really at any level until I was 14, 15. So I just never really got the art, and I'm kind of clumsy, and I just run around and kind of make an idiot of myself. Well, someone that I was playing with this morning noticed that fact, and he made it apparent that he noticed because he'd never passed me the ball, which is fine if you want your team to win. It's probably better that Austin Barker doesn't get his hands on the ball very often. But he was on the opposing team in this case, and he came to me after one play, and he says to me, let's see, how did he say this? Don't you set a moving screen on me. Watch it. That was his line to me, to try and convince me that I was wrong in the way that I had behaved on the defense on the last play. I don't know this guy. I actually don't even know his name. I play with him occasionally. Okay, he probably doesn't know my name. And he thought that he could convince me to not place a moving screen on him by coming up to me out of nowhere with no rapport and no credibility with me, and because he is a better basketball player than I, he thought that was enough that he had the right to tell me not to place a moving screen on him by saying, don't you set a moving screen on me, watch it. Okay, that is not the way to persuade someone that they are wrong. All he got from me was a quizzical look like, excuse me? Did you just say that to me? Did I just hear what I thought I heard? And then an eye roll, and then I turned my back on him and walked away. And I believe that I was totally justified. Any normal person would do exactly what I did in those circumstances. Okay? There's this thing called ethos. Okay? In logic, in rhetoric class, they will tell you about logos and ethos. Okay? And logos is the logic of your argument. So you have to, your argument has to make sense. It has to be logical. Okay, it has to be internally consistent. We were talking about this stuff earlier. Okay, but not only do you need a good argument, you actually have to be the type of person that people will listen to. And so, if this guy had come up to me, the guy I'm talking about with basketball, if he had come up to me and said something like this, let me see if I can do this. On that last screen, careful, man, I think you were probably setting a moving screen on that, so just watch out for that. Even at that, I would have been more receptive to his message. Like, because I'm a nice person, I would have probably said, sorry about that, man, I'll watch it. But you come up to me and say, don't you set a moving screen on me, watch it. Then I'm like, bristle. Okay? He had no ethos. He had no credibility. He was not the type of person, he did not portray himself to be the type of person that I would listen to. Okay? So if I can take lessons from logic from other people, and I probably can, because I don't have always the strongest arguments, and I don't even pretend to believe that I'm right all the time in the arguments that I make. And I'll give you an example before the end of the day about something that you and I might disagree with, disagree about. Okay? But if you come at me and call me a Christian snowflake, like, that's a complete non-starter. This is the lesson that you could learn from Austin Barker, is a lesson in ethos, okay? This is what I said to myself on the way here to the radio show this morning in my little monologue with this guy who had criticized my basketball. I said, I could probably learn a thing or two about basketball from you, but you could sure learn a thing or two about manners from me, okay? And so manners matter, and all of life plays by that rules, plays by those rules. It's not like when we get into politics that manners and ethos stops mattering. You still have to be, that's the contrast that Tony was serving up between Ronald Reagan and Donald Trump, is Ronald Reagan had projected an ethos. He projected an aura of a person that you wanted to like, you wanted to listen to, you were willing to be persuaded by. Donald Trump be calling people losers and stupid and idiots and all, you be calling people names, that's no ethos at all. You're not going to persuade people. And so the net result of that is the fact that people stop wanting to work for you and they stop wanting to work with you. So you can't accomplish a legislative agenda, which Donald Trump did not. His signature legislative accomplishment was the passage of the tax cuts, okay, which was good. But the bulk of his agenda was passed by executive action. Guess how much of that agenda, guess how much of that, those policies are still operative today. Hold up your hands, touch your middle finger to your thumb, and form a zero, because that was politically undone within days of Biden taking office. So Trump's legacy is that he had a lot of really good policies. That's the point that Dennis and Andy were, I think Dennis particularly, was making earlier. Trump's policies were very good. Yes, and I could make a huge list of them. But that huge list, almost all of them go in the column of accomplished by executive action and undone by executive action by Joe Biden. If Donald Trump had had the ethos to build a coalition, to build a legislative coalition, to accomplish his agenda. Listen, Joe Biden lacks the same skill. Joe Biden can't marshal a coalition. He can't even get his own people to fall in line. So it's not something that I'm saying that's true of Donald Trump, that's not true of a lot of other people. But I'm telling you, if you're going to be a politician, if you want to have a legacy that lasts, and if you want to really accomplish something, it needs to be done legislatively. And I'm not saying that the legislatures aren't cowards either. There's multiple things, you know, streams flowing into that river of why the legislature can't get things done. But I'm telling you that manners matter. Character matters. Ethos. That's what I'm talking about. Being the type of person who is worthy, deserving of respect. And if you be, if you are a respectable person, you hear that? Respectable, able to be respected, then people will respect you. I know that's a novel concept. Just, whoa, I just kind of shook the ground here. All right, so that's what we're saying, is we need somebody like Ron DeSantis, and I don't have a strong opinion, okay? You know, y'all were on the DeSantis train, and I'm not necessarily there yet because I don't know enough about him to get on that train. But that's what is being said about Ron DeSantis, is when you say things like he has a filter that Donald Trump lacks, you're talking about his ethos, his persona, his credibility. All right, last segment, Beverly. Tell us what's on your mind this morning. Welcome to the show.
Well, I don't understand the basketball reference, so forgive me. Never was my sport. But just to pose a different perspective, thought, I don't know what you exactly want to call this, but do you think, had Donald Trump not been president, good, bad, ugly, snarky comment, everything, that possibly, had he not been there, there would not be the same push today from folks, let's say, against critical race theory, or more people who are anti-abortion, or I'm not saying he was a good person. He wasn't, or isn't. I'm sorry, he's not passed away. He isn't. But I think that there were and are and will be some favorable outcomes from what we went through. Was it the best way to go through it? Not necessarily, but I was curious as to if you think that there are favorable things that have come of that presidency.
I love your question, and my answer to it unambiguously is yes. I do think that Donald Trump put wind in the sails of good causes. Is that the way you were? Is that kind of what you were thinking?
That is why you're a radio host and I'm not, because it took me a long time to say that.
Well, no, but I was thinking while you were talking, and so I can't think while I talk.
me neither, and sometimes I can't think when I'm not talking. But.
Oh, that's funny. Beverly, thank you for calling. Yes, I do. I mean, Donald Trump was the most pro-life president that I think that America has ever seen, certainly in the modern era, since Roe v. Wade. I mean, Donald Trump was the only president to show up at the March for Life in Washington, D.C. Everyone else talked a good talk. He actually walked, get it, March. He walked the walk. He showed up. And so I appreciate the momentum. I called it wind in the sails, the momentum that he gave to some really good causes. I will resist the temptation to talk about the momentum that he gave to our lower natures. Okay? I just won't talk about that. Instead, I will ask you if you believe that nice guys finish last. Because if you do, that explains a lot in terms of why you would fervently support Donald Trump, okay? Because Donald Trump was not a nice guy, and Mitt Romney and George Bush were. And if you believe that that's the reason that Mitt Romney lost the election to Barack Obama, and if you believe that that's the reason that George W. Bush was less effective than he might have been in implementing a thoroughly conservative economic agenda, if you believe those things, then it makes sense to me that because you believe nice guys finish last. I don't I don't think that's the right question. Okay, I think you're focusing on the wrong thing. I think you're throwing the baby out with the bathwater. Okay, where in this case, the bathwater is a slimy, mealy-mouthed, spineless political persona. Okay, that's the bathwater. Get rid of that. I'm going to call that weakness. Okay, I will not miss weakness when it disappears from our politicians. And that's why people voted for Donald Trump, was because he was anything but weak. He was very strong. I would even say a strong man. Okay, that was who he was. And so, but don't throw out manners. Manners is the baby. Okay, throw out weakness. Don't throw out meekness. Okay, there's no humility. Let me tell you what Blaise Pascal said. If you want to convince, in answer to this question, how do you convince someone they're wrong? And he said that if you want to tell someone how they are wrong, first tell them how they are right. So what that means is that you have to get inside their mind, and the only way to do that is by listening to them thoroughly and at some length and quietly. Okay? So totally understand what they're saying. Probably even mirror that back to them and say, if I hear you right, this is what you're saying. These are your priorities. This is your values. This is your prescription for social problems. This is what you believe is the problem. This is, and persuade that person that you fully understand their side. All right? So if you want to convince Austin Barker that he's wrong, don't call him a snowflake. Tell him that you fully understand his side. You understand why he feels the way he does, because actually this is how you feel. Is that right? Am I understanding you correctly? And then after you've done that, then say what's right about what that person believes. So if you want to tell someone how they're wrong, first tell them how they're right. Say, I'm in full sympathy with you with this and this and this. Find common ground is what I'm saying. Okay? And though that's just simple strategy, that simple rhetorical strategy in terms of persuading someone who disagrees with you, because you're establishing goodwill. You're establishing an atmosphere that promotes agreement. Now, some of you think that's the nice guy impulse. That's the weakness. It's not. It's called ethos. It's called establishing credibility. So then they will listen to you when you open your mouth. All right, whether you like him or not, you can get a primer on ethos by going to something like Dale Carnegie's book, How to Win Friends and Influence People. And you'll hear what some of you, the people who believe nice guys finish last, what you'll hear in that is this belief that Dale Carnegie is just trying to tell us to be nice. Okay, but it's not that. Let me just give you some extracts or excerpts from his book, How to Win Friends and Influence People. Here are 10 rules for how to influence people. Do you hear what that is? Influence people to your way of thinking. How to persuade people that they're wrong. 1, do not criticize, condemn, or complain. Carnegie writes, quote, any fool can criticize, condemn, or complain, and most fools do, end quote. It takes character and self-control to be forgiving. That's not a nice guy thing. It is not a nice guy thing to have character, to have self-control, and to offer forgiveness. You know what's wrong with cancel culture? It believes it, the people who have the impulse to cancel other people, they have no impulse for forgiveness. If you've done something wrong, you are unforgivable and incorrigibly bad. You're unredeemable. They, on the other hand, are morally pure. It's arrogance. Point 2, Dale Carnegie. You want to influence people? Be generous with praise. He says, I have yet to find the person, however great or exalted in their station, who did not do better work and put forth greater effort under a spirit of approval than they would ever do under a spirit of criticism. Do you hear Donald Trump in that at all? I mean, anybody who didn't live up to the standard, you're fired. You're fired. How many people did he fire from his administration? I mean, talk about a revolving door. Point 3 from Dale Carnegie, remember their name. Okay, this is, salesmen use this technique, and it feels a little greasy because they overuse it, okay? But there is a sales technique that says use a person's name. Once you're introduced to a person, use their name 10 times within the first 5 minutes of the conversation. Point four, and this one's super important in my opinion, be genuinely interested in other people. The opposite of this, or at least what I'll contrast it with, is to be genuinely interested in yourself, your cause, and your prospects for winning the argument. If all you're focused on is winning the argument, you're not going to, more likely than not. I mean, it's like one of those arguments with your wife. When you think you've won, you've lost big, okay? Because what you've compromised is your ethos, your credibility, your respectability. Five, know the value of charm. Six, be quick to acknowledge your own mistakes. Ain't hardly anything in the world that I dislike more than a know-it-all. Somebody who can't admit they're wrong. And again, if you can just take a lesson in ethos from Austin Barker, this is something that I do routinely. I'm wrong and I acknowledge it routinely. Okay, because I'm a pretty curious mind, and that means I ask a lot of questions, and that means that I'm curious. I get out there on thin ice sometimes when I'm asking questions, and I have to back off that and say, yeah, that probably wasn't a good idea. Seven, don't attempt to win an argument. Eight, begin on common ground. Nine, have others believe your conclusion is their own. This one is like called the art of diplomacy, is letting other people have your way. So make it seem like it was their idea. So it sounds like this. You're going to mirror back to them their opinion. But what you're actually going to do is quietly slip in your twist on their opinion. You're going to say, so what I hear you saying is this. And you kind of make it sound like it was something they came up with. And then 10, make people feel important. Now, I'm open to the critique that these things, that I may focus too much on ethos, okay? That I focus too much on being respectability, and that in so doing, I veer a little bit into being the nice guy, okay? But if there's an error to be made in our society today, do you think that people are being too nice to each other? Particularly in our politics? Is that really where you feel like the error resides in today's political environment? People are being too nice to each other. No. I think that the error resides in people not employing rhetorical strategies like this that are summed up under the word ethos. I think we could use some more of this. So let me just pilot this one on you, okay? Something that you might disagree with me on. This is just a closely held belief of Austin Barker. And that is, you've heard me say often that I have a complicated relationship with the American dream, okay? Because I believe two directly contradictory things. And I'm trying to figure out exactly where the correct balance is between these two things. I believe, for one, that prosperity is one of the greatest blessings and one of the greatest things about America. Like, God has blessed America with an abundance of resources, and he has favored us in such a way that we were blessed with a governmental system that incentivized prosperity, and we have capitalized on it, literally. Okay, so that's a wonderful thing about America, is the opportunity that we have to pursue wealth and prosperity. Put that side by side with the fact that I believe that prosperity is one of the most destructive features of American culture and society. Because, as Randy Alcorn said, show me one man who can handle prosperity, I can show you 100 who can handle adversity. So I think that adversity builds character in a way that prosperity does not, and prosperity is even more likely to erode good character, as in good times make weak men. Hard times make strong men. Okay, so adversity builds the character because it takes muscle. Where prosperity, it's easy to get, what's the saying, fat, happy, and stupid? It's just easy to get flabby in our character. And I believe that, like I believe my name is Austin Wendell Barker, that that there are more people who can handle adversity than can handle prosperity. And yet the predicate of America, of the American dream, the predicate is that you should get as rich as you possibly can, that there's opportunity for you to work hard and make as much money. The sky's the limit. There's no limit on that. And I say, I'm uncomfortable with that. Woe to those who would be rich, for they fall into a temptation and a snare, and they pierce themselves through with many sorrows, because godliness with contentment is great gain. I think asking about money and how rich can I be is the wrong question. The right question is, can I be content with what I have? Paul says, I've learned how to abound, I've learned how to be in want, and I've learned in whatsoever state I am therewith to be content. That's it for today, folks. Hope we stirred your mind. That's our goal. We'll see you tomorrow.